Countrywide on ABC Radio.
Support businesses are going to go to the wall just like dairy farmers will.
We've seen the whole agricultural community come out.
Once people leave communities, they generally don't return.
Countrywide.
Don't worry about me. Go and speak to your farmers.
We're already losing businesses.
Get out there and speak to your farmers with your gumboots on.
Countrywide, the politics of food and farming on ABC Radio.
Hi, I'm Warwick Long, and welcome to the program. On today's show, we'll look at the issue of smuggling meat into China and what that means for Australian beef producers, and hear about some good news that has come from 2018 in the strawberry industry and for a well-known charity.
My hope is that Jeffrey's gift will actually go towards the next new aircraft for RFDS, and I'm hoping that it will actually be based in one of our North Queensland bases. So it will actually continue to fly over Maitland Station and watch over the community that he lived in.
I'm Warwick Long, and this is Countrywide. We'll start today, though, with some sobering figures. The financial cost of drought is starting to become more clear, with the average broadacre farm income dropping by $70,000. The data from the Australian Bureau of Agriculture, Resource, Economics and Sciences has just been released, showing that broadacre and dairy farmers are the hardest hit. David Galliano is Assistant Secretary of Farm Performance and Forestry with ABARES.
And what it shows is for southeastern Australia, we're expecting farm cash income, which is simply just a measure of revenue less cash costs, for broadacre farms in southeast Australia to fall by about $70,000 per farm to an average of about $100,000.
And it probably goes without saying, but I'm presuming that drought is the main driver of that.
Yeah, absolutely. So that's exactly right. What we found is that these averages, of course, they do mask some spatial variation around the place. So in particular, where the drought has been worse, so northern and western New South Wales, for example, the results are actually worse than that. But in some other areas, further south in New South Wales, for example, where things haven't been quite as bad, the reductions are much lower.
And so how does this compare to previous droughts we've seen?
Yeah, so that's a good question. So still above the levels that we witnessed during the 2002-03 and the 2006-07 droughts. So, for example, during 2006-07, we estimated farm cash income for all industries, so dairy, grains, beef and sheep, to all be below $50,000 per farm, whereas this time around for 2018-19, we're forecasting the numbers to be somewhere between $60,000 and about $120,000 for those industries. Yeah, so look, there are some drops, but we're not yet at those levels from the previous droughts.
And so if you look at income versus profit, is it clear whether farms, broadly speaking, in the southeast of Australia will be profitable in this year?
Yeah, so we also, in the information we released today, there's another measure called farm business profit. Now, what we do with that measure is we take into account the change in basically trading stocks on farms. So farmers have in some cases, reduced number of cattle or sheep on hand or grain stocks. We've also included an allowance for depreciation and the value of family labour. And so what we're seeing there for those four industries I mentioned before, grain, sheep, beef and dairy, many of those on average are going into negative territory. I think it's only the sheep industry that's just above negative territory. So, yeah, there are some substantial effects being felt in that southeastern part of Australia.
And so you touched on the commodities. So just to expand on that, some, I gather, are being hit a bit harder than others?
Yeah, so we're finding it's really the two most heavily affected. It's the cropping sector and the dairy sector. So with cropping, it's really about lower production, as you'd expect. In the dairy industry, it's about lower milk production, but it's also about higher costs due to higher feed costs. And we've also seen a reduction in the herd size there, so that affects them more. In the beef and the sheep sectors, we're seeing relatively less impact. And in part, that's due to reasonably favourable prices for sheep and beef. So that's helping to hold those two up compared to cropping and dairy.
And you also kind of make note of summer crops and the potential role that summer crops could still play.
Yeah, absolutely. So of course, 18-19, we're only halfway through. So, look, there has been some promising rain in some areas in the last couple of months. So if that continues and we do get some decent summer crops, the numbers may end up being a little better than what we're projecting here. Hopefully that does happen. And the other thing is that in some areas where they didn't grow a winter crop, I guess they're more ready to plant a summer crop. So that could help increase these numbers as well.
David Galliano from ABARES.
What's on your dinner plate? Countrywide, the politics of food and farming.
And in 2019, one country looks like it will dominate the fortunes of international beef markets. China. Simon Quilty is a beef analyst who, together with four of his colleagues from around the world, have published an outlook for beef in 2019. And he says meat is moving around the world like never before.
I think the common message amongst everyone is how strong global beef exports are, and those analysts that preside in major buying or import countries, how strong the beef demand is. So that's the clearest message out there. The other one is, obviously, we're all focused on African swine fever, which continues to be a major factor potentially going down the track, and all the indications are starting to unfold the way we thought in terms of its global impact. So all the signs are there, and the big question being asked by each analyst is, so at what point will China start to really buy pork and therefore drive up global pork prices, which in turn is likely to drive up global beef, chicken, and lamb prices.
How much is China weighing on global markets as we look forward to 2019?
It's enormous, and particularly now in beef. And I guess that's what's been probably the revelation this year, is that their appetite for beef now is staggering. I think we've also seen some interesting changes within the Chinese market. And the main one is the real crackdown or closure of the grey trade. So prior to this, there was, as in 2018, there was enormous volumes of beef going via Vietnam and Hong Kong into China. And a good example is India, which was shipping 620,000 tonnes a year into that market. And today, that trade has almost come to a standstill. And direct shipments into China, the demand there now, as a result of the grey trade stopping, is enormous, is the demand. So prices directly into China are up because the cheaper grey trade meat is no longer present. And at the moment, it's estimated that a total of 25,000 containers are sitting in either Hong Kong or Vietnam.
Full of beef.
No, only it's 8,000 containers of beef, and the balance, the 17,000, are made up of chicken, pork, seafood, and offal items. So beef alone is about 200,000 tonnes, and that is simply not getting into that market. And once upon a time, it would cost around about $1,200 a tonne US to be smuggled across the border. Today, that's up 240%, more than double its value. So when the cost of smuggling exceeds, what happens? The customers walk away and say, keep the 30%. And that's exactly what's happened. So you have got this extraordinary situation of lots and lots of unwanted meat sitting in these Vietnam and Hong Kong that eventually will go somewhere. But I don't think, well, what we call secondary markets.
But so not China.
It won't be China. I don't believe it'll be Korea. It won't be Japan, nor will it be the US. And for us, that's all good news, because we will not have, you might say, this unwanted excess meat suddenly appearing in all our key markets. And just to clarify the makeup, just on, you know, the October figures alone, we saw Brazil made up 38% of global of Chinese imports in beef. Argentina, 25%. Australia sat third at 14%. And then Uruguay was at 13%. New Zealand and Canada followed after us. So we are now third in terms of the largest supplier into China. But unfortunately, I think that that's restricted because we do not have the number of plants approved for China to take advantage of this growing market. And that's a lot of politics, as we know. And what's interesting is Brazil, only 2 weeks ago, has had an extraordinary number of plants approved literally overnight, 78 in total. And that's on the back of their concerns over supply risk.
Can that directly be related to Australia's relationship with the US and that China-US relationship being poor at the moment? Brazil sitting to the side of that, getting direct access.
You bet. There is no doubt in my mind that there is a lot of politics going on, and the relationship we keep stubbing our toe on is the Chinese one. And I realise that, you know, that's not what people want to hear, but that's reality.
Brazil, what are they looking like in 2019?
It looks really good for Brazil. And after some of the issues they've had over the last 12 to 18 months with the meat scandal that went on and lots of other things, just in the last few weeks, again, we've got Russia, who has stepped in and is now approved Brazil to start re-exporting into Russia. Now, 4 years ago, that was the major market for Brazilian exports, and Russia took around about 300,000 metric tons 4 years ago, almost exactly the same amount that China's taking today out of Brazil. So you've got a really interesting situation that within 12 months, two heavyweights, Russia and China, will both be vying for Brazilian beef, along with all the other countries that Brazil serves.
Let's keep moving then to the US, a major trading partner of ours and a huge giant in world beef markets. How are they looking in 2019?
Well, the forecasts are higher or record production in beef, pork and chicken. And so that was really that big underlying concern, is when the US is swamped in protein, that eventually we're going to see market or prices fall, and with that Australian prices fall. But what's kept the beef prices and cattle prices buoyant within the US has been their incredible global exports. And that just continues to happen. And they're now at record exports at 13.5% on the back of record production. So they are absolutely braining it on the global markets. Without that export market as strong as it is, the value of their cattle would be 20% less than what it is today. So the trade war issues still become, Warwick, a huge deal.
And I suppose then that just leaves us. 2019, it's obviously been a very big drought year in Australia, and that has hit our beef herd. What does 2019 look like?
Well, the $64 question is, when is the drought going to break? I think that we'll be seeing in excess of 1 million head by June next year coming out of the herd. Takes us back to well below 27 million. And if the drought continues through 2019, it'll put us below around about 26.2, 0.3 million. Why that's so important is that it means that when we rebound and the rain comes, that the rebound will be dramatic, that we will lift prices and see global meat prices and cattle prices come in line, which therefore means if that's to occur, we're going to see well above the records of October 2016, and I think we'll get close to $8 a kilo carcass weight versus back in 2016, it was $7.25.
So new records.
New records.
Beef analyst Simon Quilty speaking there. And since we've talked about the movement of beef, particularly into China, let's talk about some more of that now, with a shipment of South Australian beef being flown to Shanghai this week, armed with the latest technology to tackle food fraud. Food fraud is where products are mislabeled, tampered or substituted. It's the kind of issue where UK horse meat turned up in meat patties in Europe a few years ago. Well, Brisbane-based company Beef Ledger has teamed up with the Queensland University of Technology for a trial shipment. Chair Warwick Powell says the high-end beef cuts will be heading to China, the epicentre of food mislabeling.
Food fraud is estimated to be a $40 billion US dollar a year problem. What that is food that is being sold in marketplaces around the world that isn't what it really is. Whether it is actual product substitution, such as donkey meat being sold for beef, or pork being sold for beef, or product that is from one country being represented as if it's product from another country. Food fraud takes many, many forms, and the research from global researchers in the US estimates it to be a $40 billion US dollar a year problem.
How much does this concern consumers? You say you've got a Chinese background. Tell us from your perspective how concerned the consumers are about this.
Consumers in places like China are incredibly concerned about food fraud and food safety. They have, over the course of the last 15 years, experienced rapid economic growth. And what that has done, as household wealth has increased, is driven the ability of households to buy all sorts of new things. But of course, the ability of the world to supply those new things, whether it's higher order proteins, whether it's milk powder, seafoods, etc., because of the limitations, prices have risen. And when prices rise significantly, it does suck in a marketplace of fraudulent misrepresentation. We've seen it in not only a range of consumer goods, and the classics is, of course, handbags and T-shirts and shoes and all those sorts of things and fake watches, but we have seen it now encroach into the food space. So seafoods, wines, dairy products, milk powders, and, of course, meat proteins.
Which area of the world is most vulnerable for food fraud?
Look, certainly the Chinese marketplace is recognised both by Chinese researchers and also global researchers as one of the hotspots for food fraud. The marketplace there is very, very large, obviously, and it has been going through significant economic development and transformation, which creates the ripe conditions for fraudulent or bad actors to try to make significant margins or take advantage of consumers looking for better products.
Australia is a massive food exporter. How is your company, with government funding, looking at this area and reducing the amount of fraud that can happen against our products?
Look, what we're trying to do is to develop a multi-layered set of systems that will enhance the credentialing of Australian products. And what that's really about is delivering information and technologies to consumers that they can be confident in the authenticity of what it is that we're selling. Is this Australian? Yes, it is. Where's it from? It's from Australia. It's from the Limestone Coast. It's from the Sunshine Coast of Queensland. It's from the Central Highlands or the Darling Downs or wherever. People want to know with confidence that the product is from where it claims to be. That's the first thing that the research shows in terms of the Chinese consumer. So we're working with a range of technologies from blockchain through to packaging through to really clever anti-counterfeiting scanning, as well as a range of economic mechanisms to create system integrity and deliver confidence to consumers. That's what we're doing. So our first shipment is leaving today. It is a proof of concept or a demonstration shipment of both high-end product, which is from our partners at Limestone Coast, but it's also a way in which we can showcase a range of our technologies to gain feedback from the wholesale market and the restaurant market and the consumer market about the sorts of things they're looking for to give them confidence in the claims that are being made about the product and its origin.
So this is a shipment of beef from South Australia. How does technology help guarantee that product? Are you tampering with the product at all, or is it is it around the packaging?
One of our operating principles, if you will, is to have a non-invasive approach. An invasive approach really is about either adding something to the meat itself or being able to extract something for DNA testing. Now, we appreciate the importance, ultimately, of being able to validate provenance through laboratory testing, if, in fact, that's what's needed. But we're also reluctant to add things to the product itself for fear that that becomes another layer of fraud risk itself. So the approach we've adopted is to develop a range of multi-technologies, if you will, in the packaging that will ensure that consumers have confidence in the veracity of the packaging itself.
So by doing this, you're able to guarantee the beef that Australia sends over, but it still can't guarantee what's next to it, can it?
No, it can't. What we do though, is that we are making the contrast between the fake and the real very, very clear. The challenge has historically been when counterfeits become really, really good at copying the real thing, that consumers have no way of telling the difference. Now, what we're doing, of course, is making sure that consumers have a better way of telling the difference between the real and the fake.
Warwick Powell from Beef Ledger speaking with Amy Phillips. Let's move away from meat now and have a good news story, which has emerged from the strawberry contamination crisis, which devastated the industry earlier this year. At the height of the needle crisis, Lyra Vinegar in southern Queensland salvaged tons of dumped strawberries and turned them into vinegar. That's now being sold to benefit a food charity. Vinegar maker Ian Henderson told Jody Gunders why he was moved to take action.
Jody, I hate waste. I mean, I hate waste of any sort. And I was watching hundreds of tons of strawberries go onto the ground, you know, from the needle contamination a few months ago. And there's a lot of farm. I can see strawberry farms out the window of my office here of guys dumping strawberries. So it had to do something. So we went and rescued a couple of tons of strawberries off the ground and turned them into some strawberry vinegar. And then just, I guess, more or less to prove that we could do it. And then we wondered what we were going to do with it after we made it. So we approached Food Bank to rescue food from food manufacturers and retailers and restaurants and redistribute it back to disadvantaged people. So we decided we would print a label and we're selling them online, and 100% of the proceeds go to Food Bank. So this is the opportunity to rescue some food that was destined for waste and turn it into help to disadvantaged people in Australia at Christmas time.
Food waste was heartbreaking for the growers as well. What was their reaction when you approached them to pick up some of these strawberries?
I rang a good friend of ours, Gavin at Pinata Strawberries, one of the biggest strawberry growers in the country, and I just said, do you get a couple of tonne of strawberries you could run over here? And he said, I've got 20 tonne in a truck that I'll just drive straight to you if you like. And he was pretty stoic about it, to be honest. Like, I think farmers are generally very resilient and just get on with the business. And he was, I don't think he was happy about it, but he was just getting on with the business of picking strawberries and dumping them. And he was just, to be honest, extremely excited that something positive could happen with them. So we explained pretty quickly that we would do something positive and we would somehow raise some money for charity with them, and he couldn't get them here fast enough.
It sounds amazing. What would you use it for? What would you suggest people use it for?
Well, look, this is summer salad time. I would put it in any salad that had something bitter, something sweet, and something oily. So I go a bit of rocket leaves, some walnuts for that oily bitterness, and fresh strawberries, maybe some feta cheese or something. It's actually beautiful. I mean, just smells like strawberries. I'm not easily impressed with my own work sometimes, but this is beautiful. This really is one of the nicest things we've ever made. And we made it from some strawberries that were going to the ground.
Lyra Vinegar's Ian Henderson speaking to Jody Gunders there. Still in Queensland, a Queensland grazier has left almost $10 million in his will to the Royal Flying Doctor Service and Children's Hospital Foundation. Geoffrey Carrick owned Maitland Station in far north Queensland, and he passed away in June at the age of 73. His 138 square kilometre property was sold at auction for $9.85 million, with all the money going to charity. Auctioneer Matthew Gainey says the bequest included the largest single donation to the Royal Flying Doctor Service.
The instructions of the estate were to leave the funds there to the Royal Flying Doctor and goes to the Queensland Children's Hospital Foundation.
How much did the property end up selling for at auction?
Yeah, we sold at auction $9.85 million.
That's a pretty enormous donation. Is that probably the biggest solid donation you know that has gone to the Royal Flying Doctor Service?
In talking to the reps there, I believe it is the largest single donation that's been donated to the Royal Flying Doctor Service, yes.
And it's very generous, so half going to Royal Flying Doctors and half going to the Queensland Children's Hospital Foundation. What was the connection for the gentleman to donate to these worthy causes?
Jeff has always been donating towards causes and other foundations as well as those two that have been mentioned. And in the past, they've been very generous and even donating and presenting some very good sets of horns in the previous years to our big country Brahmin sale that we've had. And those proceeds auctioned in previous times were donated to the Royal Children's Hospital.
And what can you tell us about Geoffrey? What kind of man was he?
He wasn't very much out there amongst the people per se. He enjoyed his time, he enjoyed his cattle. Enjoyed the land. Very, very nice person.
Joe Burram and his wife, Sandra, are managers on the Maitland property, and Joe has known Geoff for most of his life.
Probably 64 years, because my father worked for his father in the timber industry.
So you were just a little one when you met?
Yes, very.
And did you go to school together, the two of you?
Well, he was a few years ahead of me, but yes. When I left Ravenshoe in 1968, and I joined the Air Force, and I hadn't seen Geoff then for quite a few years after I got out of the Air Force, and it was probably around about the year 2000, 99 to 2000, that I run into Geoff, and it was as though that we were long-lost brothers and hadn't missed a day of seeing each other. And we've been together basically ever since.
And you and your wife have been managing the station, is that right?
Yes.
I've heard that it may have been a snake bite, is that correct?
Well, they don't really know. There was a puncture marks on his leg, but we still don't know what the test results are from. They did not find any external venom. However, it was through genes, and if it was a brown snake bite, it is not uncommon to not find external venom. But it was probably, he had a dibbed heart disease, and it was probably that was the main contender in his death.
For those that maybe didn't know Geoff, what could you tell us about him that made him so special and made him such a great man?
He loved children. My grandchildren come here, and when he was alive, and they bypassed me to go and see Uncle Geoffrey. He loved them. We'd go down to we've got the Irnsley River running through this property, and we'd go down there with all our grandchildren, and Geoff would come down fishing with them, and they'd yell out to him to come swimming, so he would jump in clothes and all and go swimming with the grandchildren. He was just one that simply adored all children. I think that's one of the big factors as to why he's donated so much, or half the proceeds, to the Children's Hospital. And because of the remote area we were in, he had a lot of time for the RFDS. He believed that they could get as much as they could possibly get. They needed it.
The Royal Flying Doctors is a lifeline for people living in regional areas, and Catherine Ash, the fundraising manager for the Royal Flying Doctors, says they're incredibly grateful for such a generous donation.
Look, everyone was pretty blown away, to be honest with you. When we first heard that Geoffrey was going to be leaving a gift to the RFDS and the estate was sort of coming, we knew that it was going to be big, but we had no idea how big.
It is an amazing donation. What will that money be used for at the Royal Flying Doctor Service?
So many people don't know how much an aircraft actually costs. So a new aircraft for RFDS costs almost $10 million and another $2.5 million to actually fit it out. And because our aircraft are operating 24/7, 365 days of the year, we have to buy a new one every 1 to 2 years. So it's a really big investment for the organisation. My hope is that Geoffrey's gift will actually go towards the next new aircraft for RFDS, and I'm hoping that it will actually be based in one of our North Queensland bases, so it will actually continue to fly over Maitland Station and watch over the community that he lived in.
Catherine Ash, fundraising manager for the Royal Flying Doctor Service, ending that report by Amanda Cranston. That's it for Countrywide this week and this year. Remember, you can find our podcast at abc.net.au/rural, just under the Programs tab there. Hope you have a great holidays, and we'll talk to you in the new year. Goodbye.